Everyone, please welcome Webster Tarpley from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. I have to thank Nick for his very kind words. The only thing I could take issue with is a somewhat slighting reference to outer boroughs. Outer boroughs, inner boroughs, where is the center after all? I'm someone who lived in Flushing, Queens for a long time. I went to PS 23, PS 20, junior high school 185, Flushing High School. My uncle was actually a New York City policeman. And to us out there in Flushing, it was always a question about where the center really was. So apart from that Manhattan-centric attitude, I'm sure we can get along fine. Now, this is my issue of tonight. I'm essentially trying to show the continuity of the 9/11 regime. The fact that the September criminals, the people inside the U.S. government, a network in the Pentagon, the CIA, the NSA, what I refer to as the secret government or the parallel government, the rogue network, the secret team, the invisible government, terms of this type, they're still in power, and they still have their agenda, which is for war, and it's now for a wider war. The wider war involves Syria, it involves Iran, it may involve North Korea, Venezuela, or other places around the world. So I'm trying to show you why September 11th is the key issue for fighting that 9/11 regime, which of course is increasingly dictatorial, and being able to undercut their plans for wider wars. And one of my underlying theses is, if you're from the peace movement, you must by now face the fact that unless Bush's base is destroyed, he will continue to wage war. He'll stay in office, he'll continue to wage war. There is no amount of polemic on Iraq as such, or Syria as such, or Iran as such, that will destroy that base. The only thing that begins to erode and attrit Bush's base, the political phenomenon that allows him to make war, is to attack the 9/11 myth, the myth of the hijackers, the myth of terrorism. Back in the 1930s, Dr. Goebbels of the Nazi propaganda machine and his friends, another one by the name of Alfred Rosenberg, talked about the myth of the 20th century. They said it was nationalism. Terrorism is now the myth of the 21st century. It is the basis of all of the crimes that are perpetrated. It's the basis of this government, the Republican Party. Even down to property relations, the entire social order seems to depend on the notion of fear and terrorism. We're living in a reign of terror, and it's a nightmare from which we need to exit. And this is part of what I'm trying to do. So therefore, it's the 9/11 issue, but not as a matter of antiquarianism, not as a matter of backward-looking even history, although I hold history in extremely high regard, not history in the way that it might be misinterpreted, but rather as a key to doing things today. Now let's see if our it works. Okay, this is my book. Now, some of the things in my speech are going to be obscure. I'm sorry. If they're not understandable, please buy my book. I'm not trying to make them obscure, but sometimes it's just unavoidable, especially for those who are coming in right off the freshly from not having ever been here before. This book was completed in late fall of 2004. But I'm very pleased to announce that tonight is the world premiere of the second edition. The second edition, updated to, it's actually updated to Guy Fawkes Day of last year, November 5th. We'll talk about Guy Fawkes in a minute. We just had the 400th anniversary of Anglo-American terrorism. But that was Guy Fawkes. And you'll find, I think, that the introduction, although it's not extremely long, does deal with some of the things that have for me now become the central features of the whole polemic against 9/11. The myth, I mean. Now, I know there are new people, and you put me in and I'm so delighted that new people are here, you put me in the position of having to do two things. One is to try to satisfy the new people who would like to have an ABC introduction to this entire thing, but then of course we also have here large numbers of seasoned experts who have been dealing with this for 4 years plus. I've got to try to balance those two. I would just say to the new people, you'll probably find that the beginning is going to be, once we get through some pictures, we're going to get into some other things that may seem to be a little bit confusing. That will be the able danger question, which I regard as an important point. But then we will get to a phase of about 10 or 15 minutes where we can talk about the obvious anomalies, impossibilities, physical impossibilities of the official version. But I have to ask for everybody's patience tonight, because what I'm trying to put out is, it's called my hop, right? Made it happen on purpose. That is my theoretical standpoint. I think it's important, and I'll try to show you why. It means that we're going to have to enter into a world that we never wanted to enter into, and that is the nightmare world of Pentagon acronyms, Pentagon code names, and military plans, because the key to 9/11 is not to be found in some cave in Afghanistan or in the sands of Saudi Arabia. It's to be found in the Pentagon, in Arlington, Virginia, or in Langley, Virginia, the CIA, or other bureaus of the U.S. government. And then, of course, ultimately, the Wall Street financiers who, in a general way, control what those people do. So that's where you have to look at it. And that's my truth in labeling. Made in USA. Nowhere else. Made in USA. Not in China? No, maybe. No, not even print. This is actually, the book is actually printed in USA, too. So get it that way. Next. Okay, my background is I come from a study in the 1970s of NATO spheres of influence terrorism. This is 1978. Who killed Aldo Moro, the prime minister? And the answer, as you see, is NATO intelligence, or the British. The British, the U.S., NATO intelligence. And my standpoint on September 11th is that this is also an example of NATO spheres of influence terrorism, what you can call geopolitical terrorism, coming, however, from the NATO command in the same way that those Red Brigades who kidnapped and killed Moro were ultimately controlled by NATO intelligence. So this is the thing that I studied, and I find that this is a very, very profitable way to look at the issue. This is, of course, what we have today, the American Leviathan, right? We've got a Leviathan state breathing down our necks. Administrative fascism. It's different from the older fascism. It doesn't seem to really have that kind of street fighting aspect to it. Although when you see something like the Minutemen patrolling borders, you get an idea that the street fighting part may not be that far away. But generally, administrative fascism under the Bush regime, that was, of course, 1991, Bush the Elder, and now I think it's full-blown. That's my other book. That's the book that covers the Bush the Elder. It's the only critical biography of him ever written, I'm afraid. It's very interesting that, since Nick mentioned it, when in January 15th, 1991, we were on the verge of the Iraq War, there were indeed surface-to-air missiles placed on top of the White House and guys with these shoulder-mounted missiles running around. But in 2001, there were none, according to most reports. So they said they went to highest alert in 2001, but they didn't choose to protect the White House, indicating my thesis that the coup faction wanted to have the option of destroying the White House. And why not? Why not make the whole thing more effective? And indeed, there are plans, there are indications that the plane that went down in Shanksville was doing exactly that. So we have to talk about the horror of September 11th and the fact that it has transformed international relations and politics inside this country. The problem is, for most people, it's a totally unexamined premise. How can you say we live in a new world based on something of which you know almost nothing? And believe me, we know almost nothing compared to what we need to know. The trail of terror, right? Living in a world of terror, right? The message of the Bush administration, be afraid, always be afraid, right? Franklin D. Roosevelt told us the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Now, it's a different message coming from the government. And, of course, the demonized perpetrators, starting with Mohammed Atta, right, the evil incarnate in this amazingly Manichaean world that they inhabit. Now, it's not new. And as I mentioned just before, I can't talk about this, but I have another slideshow of about 2 hours that I was fortunate enough to give in Cork, Ireland, last November. A good audience, right place to give this kind of a lecture. This is Guy Fawkes, right? This is the guy who's trying to allegedly, blow up the Houses of Parliament, the House of Lords, with the King, the Commons, the Lords, and everybody else, the whole elite of the country, in November 1605. And there he is, Guy Fawkes. And you get to learn about the memes, right? The memes, you'll see the memes of 9/11, right? The elements of a myth. He's got to have spurs, he's got to have a lantern. And he's got to be going in, and they catch him because he's just about to light the powder trains to blow the whole thing up. Now, the story is, who sent him? The Pope, the Jesuits, the Spanish. And in reality, none of those. And we get to see the notion of patsies. These are the patsies of 1605. There's Guy Fawkes, Guido Fawkes, Thomas Percy, Robert Winter, and a bunch of others. Now, the majority are double agents. The majority. As a matter of fact, almost all of them, there's only really one of them, maybe Robert Winter, who may not be a double agent. But otherwise, they're all double agents. Something that teaches us about 9/11. Now, this is the Bush of the day. This is James the First. He was, you know, full of inertia. He didn't want war. He wanted to marry his children in a certain way. But that wasn't good enough for the faction that was actually controlling the government. In other words, a figurehead king, a figurehead president, a puppet president. So he has to be pushed into a much more aggressive posture. Next, please. And there is the head of the invisible government in those days, Lord Robert Cecil, Lord Salisbury, the founder of a political faction which exists today in London, and it's very strong. It's practically called the Conservative Party, although not only. So here's the Prime Minister of the country who organized the plot using a group of desperate double agents. I point to this because the U.S.-British financier faction that we're dealing with, in its birth pangs, had recourse to terrorism on what was for the time a fairly monstrous scale. And now the death agony of the Anglo-American financier faction is marked by the same thing. And I think this is an interesting pattern. Other writers, an Italian called Sanguinetti, have also remarked on this, and I've put it in the book. Now, here in the United States, we're dealing with this secret government. When did the secret government start? Hard to say. Probably sometime after the Civil War. Probably sometime, certainly before you had the battleship Maine blown up in Havana Harbor. The most recent study by Admiral Rickover, famous admiral, found that the explosion came from inside the boat. So, an inside job. Not done by the Spanish who were controlling Havana Harbor. But here we have the Hearst Press. Okay? Here's the Maine. Here's an underwater mine. And here we have algunos bin Ladenitos. Los bin Ladenitos Españoles with their periscope, and they're about to blow it up. And it says, "This picture fixes the responsibility to the satisfaction of the American people." So take heart, right? Those fascist parrots you hear on the radio every afternoon, and O'Reilly and Hannity and all the fascist parrots. They're not new. That's just the Hearst Press on the air with their usual jingoistic yellow garbage. Next. And remember, McKinley was not interested in going to war, really, but he was forced to by the furor created in the Congress. In other words, you stampede the Congress and you get what you want. So that's nothing new. There's also a tradition, it's more recent. I don't know if you noticed this, but for people my age, this should have been a kind of an earth-shaking event. In, I believe it was September of 05, the National Security Agency, in the news these days, has conceded that most of the allegations of the Gulf of Tonkin incident of August 1964 were false. But they were not ordered by Lyndon B. Johnson or Dean Rusk or McNamara. No, no. Those were middle-level employees covering up, CYA, and that's what it was. Now, too bad for the 60,000 people who died in that war from this side. Too bad for the 2 to 3 million on the other side. Too bad for Cambodia destroyed and left in prey to a fascist dictatorship. It was a fake. So get used to the idea that they lie and they fake, and not only in the previous century, but also quite recently in your lifetime, enough to have impacted you or most people here in the room. Now, let's begin to talk a little bit about the impossibilities of the official version. And I want to take this opportunity to come up with some news in terms of Abel Danger. One of the problems with this is you have these 19 people, and nobody knows where they come from. There's no proof that they had any connection to anything. Some of them are from Saudi Arabia, but some of them are not, right? Atta is from Egypt, apparently, if he exists. We're in a realm of pure myth. And there's also the tremendous problem of whether these people could ever, like Atta or Jara over here, or Hani Hanjour, probably the most inept, could they have ever piloted these planes, right? And there seems to be the answer is no. Well, the 9/11 Commission report, right, the Governor Kane and Lee Hamilton and so forth from July of 05 says, well, those are the people who did it. Now, we have to pause for a second. If you believe the official version, and I say this to everybody, if you believe the official version, what you are saying is that Bush was a liar. Most people, I think, would agree with this. Bush was a liar up until September 11th. And then, strangely, for a couple of months, he told the truth. And then he went back to being a liar again. Right? So here's the whole government, through the voice of David Kane, saying, when it comes to Iraq, we were all wrong. Well, we lied. You weren't wrong. You lied. So can you believe, can anybody believe, and this is where you got to get to the gatekeepers. If you profess the official version, you are saying Bush lied in the campaign, everybody knows, but then after 9/11 he told the truth, and then he went back to lying. No. He lied before, during, and after. Now, my method essentially regards terrorist events as composites. They're a point of intersection of three or four different levels of reality. And the main thing you have to understand is you've got certainly the people you see, right, the ones we've just showed you, Atta and company. Those are the dupes, the useful idiots, the fanatics, but above all, the double agents who run them. Those are the scapegoats who are going to take the fall. The problem you always have to apply is, does the patsy have the physical, technical ability to create the effects observed? Can Lee Harvey Oswald, using the Mannlicher Carcano 1917 rifle, successfully fire the requisite number of shots with bolt action in the time that he has? No. And it doesn't depend on his criminal intent. He can have all the criminal intent in the world. It won't let him do it. And these guys, you can say, oh, they hate us. Oh, they hate us. Doesn't matter how much they hate you. They can't do it. Okay, so this is a whole world of provocateurs, double agents. This is sort of the wormy underside of FBI, CIA, NSA, the rest of them. You've also got to look for moles, government officials loyal to a private network. This is important. They don't follow the chain of command, even. They're not certainly not loyal to a constitution, but they're rather loyal to a clique. It's ultimately in Wall Street, but it's also senior government officials, generals, and people like this. Those are the moles. They also have to organize the cover-up. The moles have to make sure that nobody interferes with the patsies before the fact. Not because the patsies are going to carry out the attack, but because if the patsies are already in jail, you can't blame the crime on the patsies. So they've got to stay free, and then they've got to be arrested immediately, and you've then got to have a cover-up. And then you have professional killers. There's got to be a role in this for, I believe, a privatized command center. There's got to be a role for assassins, in other words, people like the people who really killed Kennedy, coming into town, getting out of town. Patsies love attention. They love to get on TV. Again, Oswald gets on TV, gets on the radio, gets noticed. Atta, same thing, right? Always fighting with people, abrasive. Then the professional killers, who don't say anything. They come in, shoot, leave. They're not ideologues in the same sense. They're not interested in popping off in public. Before we leave, just a privatized command center. Again, outside, I believe, certainly not Dick Cheney. Can you imagine you're going to have this whole operation, you're going to make it depend on a guy who's 4 heart attacks and 3 pacemakers, sitting there with his wife who keeps turning the CNN up so you can't hear the interagency task force talking? And the whole thing doesn't work without the brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media. Okay? And that's state-sponsored false flag terrorism, because the thing says we're Al-Qaeda, and they're not Al-Qaeda, they're a branch of CIA and MI6. How are we doing? Are we stuck? Don't tell me.
Yeah, could you take a look at this? Maybe the cursor's moved or something?
Go ahead. Okay. Now, it became clear very soon after 9/11 that Atta was a double agent. You open up Newsweek magazine, it says Atta and the others lived on U.S. military bases and were trained at U.S. military bases. Well, what can it mean? Daniel Hapsiker's research, right? Those guys were double agents, Atta and company. So what you've got to imagine is you've got a number of double agents. Let's assume there were 19. We don't know, we're just guessing. Let's assume there were 19. How many were double agents? Guys who knew that they were agents. A third? A half? How many were dupes? How many were fanatics? People who don't know what they're doing, right? Psychotics, who have no idea. Those are very much in demand because they don't know what's being done to them. So the double agent reports back to a case officer. How do you know that the double agents are telling you the truth? How do you know that the double agents haven't gotten themselves together to tell you some story to get more money or to do what you want? Well, you need electronic eavesdropping. And that is where Able Danger comes in. I'm going to give you a version. I hope you've heard of Able Danger. It's been a big deal for the past 6 months or so. I'm going to try to show you what's involved. And this has to do with a guy who quit the Defense Intelligence Agency in October 2000 when he said, they're going to blow up a battleship. They're going to blow up a warship in Yemen. And they said, no, forget it, go home. Then they blew up exactly one of these ships. But it's more complicated than it seems. Now here's Able Danger, founded in 1999 by Hugh Shelton, the commander of military forces on the day of, and a guy called Shoemaker. I want you to know who Shoemaker is, because he was then the boss of the Special Forces Command, SOCOM. Now these are the suspects. If you look at the Army in general, the suspects are the Special Forces Command and the Intelligence Command. Those are the crazy ones. That's where the criminals are in large numbers. And this Shoemaker, well, he's the head of the Army today. So he's been promoted. Another good thing to do. Look for the crime, then see who gets promoted after the crime. These are things that can't really be hidden, right? They can't be hidden. So Able Danger has a staff of 11 people plus contractors, one of them called Orion Scientific. And they say, we're doing data mining. We're finding all about, we take the secret stuff and we put it together with the public domain stuff and we come up with a picture of what Al-Qaeda is doing. This is related to something called LIWA, Land Warfare Information Activity. One of the people involved has his own group of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Stratus Ivy. Now you're already getting fed up with these code names, right? But you gotta get serious now, because if you don't fight through this stuff, you can't understand. Because think about this. This is $500 billion a year. There are all these little people doing all these little things. You have to know about it. You can't sit back there and expect, you know, Democracy Now! To tell you, because they won't, right? So these people come up stuff with that Condi and Perry are both security risks because of China, but that's the least of what they do. Shoemaker, look at him. He retired in November 2000. He came back as the head of the Army in 2003. He's a special forces utopian. He was there at Desert One when they tried to go into Tehran and get the hostages out. So he has a history of defeats in special forces operations. And he fired, there was some kind of a faction fight in the military last summer. There was General Burns of TRADOC, the Training and Training Command. And in 2005, this guy Burns was fired by Shoemaker. So Shoemaker is a real dirty character.
Four-star general.
Four-star, yes, exactly. And so was Burns. Now, my thesis is Able Danger are the terrorist controllers. Mohammed Atta, he can't get through the day. He's got to have money. He's got to have help. I think some commonplaces about these guys. They can't find the men's room without the help of a CIA covert operation. There are people who are so inept that they can't get a driver's license in most states, except possibly New Jersey. They're basket cases. A lot of them are just basket cases. So they have to have a comprehensive backup operation. Now, Able Danger has a charter. According to Congressman Weldon, who's telling us all this stuff, Able Danger is tasked to manipulate, degrade, or destroy terrorist groups. As soon as they say manipulate, those are terrorist controllers. Okay? Terrorist controllers, case officers, babysitters for Atta. The main consumer of Able Danger intelligence is Major General Jeffrey Lambert, Special Forces. And he tells them, he says, look, they have a chart with all these Al-Qaeda characters, including Atta, before the fact, before September 11th. And he says, wait a minute, you can't go investigating those people. You can't tell the FBI or the CIA anything about them. And he gets these yellow post-it notes, and he puts one on Atta's face, saying, that reminds you, you can't share information about them. Now, if you read the official version, they're very adamant that Atta and company were not in the U.S. in early 2000 and that the U.S. government knew nothing about them. However, the NSA was monitoring their calls. I put this up here also to call your attention to a nice book, Morgan and Henschel, 9/11 Revealed, The Unanswered Questions. These are two British guys who published a book last year that probably deserves more attention than it's gotten. And there may be more Able Dangers. According to the main whistleblower on Able Danger was a high-risk, high-gain operation. Some of these are still ongoing, of course. For every significant terror group, there has to be a terrorist controller group that tells them what to do, that gets them out of bed in the morning and puts them to bed at night. Now, specifically, they knew about these people living in the Bronx and Brooklyn in early 2000, and then in Wayne, New Jersey. They're told that they can't share it with the FBI. That's, of course, exactly what a mole does, protect the patsies. And they told, of all people, Philip Zelikow, the head of the staff of the 9/11 Commission, and he ignored everything. So the 9/11 Commission, just based on this, is a fraud and has to be thrown out. In other words, it's time to reopen 9/11. But this is the least of it, because they lied, you know, six or seven different ways before they were finally caught. But what nobody has pointed out, to my knowledge, except for myself, is that these are not just people who are observing the terrorists. They're observing them because they control them, and they want to make sure that their orders are followed. There's also a famous flowchart from Weldon, which he claims he gave to the White House in September 01, and the chart has been, he said, I'll show it to Bush, and the chart, according to some accounts at least, has disappeared, even though it's got Atta on it. So they knew exactly who these people were, of course, because they were telling them what to do. Now, most incriminating, in the spring of 2000, Able Danger destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data, equal to one quarter of the printed books in the Library of Congress. A large number, right? Your 4 million, 5 million books destroyed. Now here's a guy, Eric Kleinsmith, of the Army Land Information Warfare Activity, destroyed the data. Now people have heard of Dave Frasca of the FBI, right? The guy who ignored the Phoenix warning and the Minneapolis warning. How about this guy? He should be just as notorious. He's the one who destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on orders from who? The main lawyer of the Special Forces. So the Special Forces lawyer says, destroy that data or you'll be arrested. Literally what he tells him. And then, later on, as the thing unfolds in March 01, and then in spring of 04 yet, they destroy more data. Now, I'm telling you, that is a huge scandal. And the scandal is not that they told the 9/11 Commission something that the 9/11 Commission ignored. The scandal is that this group was running terrorism. And here's the other part of the analysis. Every year, there's a drill called Able Warrior. Able Warrior, again, I have to, you know, this, there's just no way around these names. This is what they, these names that they make up for themselves. Able Warrior is a yearly drill of the special forces. It's worldwide, and the theme is only one thing, anti-terrorism. Now, if you look at the way that they do this, they have drills in binary pairs. One side pretends to be the defenders, and the other side pretends to be the attackers. Okay? So if Able Warrior are the defenders, anti-terrorism, what's Able Danger? Able Danger is a troop of attackers to be used to simulate attacks during anti-terror drills. In other words, those double agents are there as actors, if you like, in normal drills, but then at a certain point, wham, the drill goes live and something happens, and they find themselves caught up in 9/11. Now, at the level of speculation, there's another code name that keeps coming out in the middle of all the Able Danger stuff, and it is Door Hop Galley. And I don't think anybody knows what it is, except some guy on the internet who says there's a secret cell inside Able Danger, which is Door Hop Galley. And it's mentioned by the congressman, and we don't get to find out. In other words, we didn't have a chance to hear testimony from these people because Rumsfeld, in September of last year, said you're not allowed to testify. So there is a little window into your $500 billion of defense spending at work. Door Hop Galley. Now, my approach, my current approach to 9/11 is heavily that this was the day of the drills. And I have 15, but there are more. And you'll get to see some of these. I'm afraid you'll get to know them a little bit better than you want to by the time we're over. But this just gives you the idea. As far as I know, 9/11 has the highest concentration of military drills of any day in recent U.S. history. And the only thing that comes close, I believe, is sometime last October, November, when there was a similar concentration of drills. And I'll try to show you a Pentagon chart about that. Okay. So here's Myers, who's now outgoing, gone. Peter Pace is in. And here's Shelton. Here's Wolfowitz at the World Bank. And here's Rumsfeld. And they plan drills. That's what they do all the time. And the idea is the way they drill is the way they fight. So whatever they drill, you have to ask yourself, are they drilling that so that they can do it, learn to do it in the future, or actually do it in the present? Now, let's take a breath. Let's go back to some easier stuff. The obvious empirical problems in the 9/11 official story, right? Why it's physically impossible. I already mentioned one of them. You take a look at those patsies, basket cases as they were, and you're told that they can carry out feats of piloting acrobatics that are beyond most experienced fighter pilots, airline pilots, or whatever it is. The answer is obviously no. Now, my book argues Global Hawk. In other words, that the answer is that there are airplanes with people in them, and that this Global Hawk is a remote control system that the government demonstrably has. They use it to fly airplanes across the Pacific and other purposes. It simply takes over the controls of the aircraft and flies it into a target according to a plan that is dictated by the ground computer that has taken over. And I still think there's a strong argument for this. However, I have to tell you that the direction of research in the past year or so, to the extent that there is research, goes in the direction of challenging this by pointing to the anomalies and problems of the planes hitting the buildings. The alleged bulges on the bottom of the plane, the dots that appear on the side of the building, and so forth. And I think all of that has to be taken quite seriously, and those researchers have to be taken seriously. The only problem with it is, if you hold something up for somebody, somebody sees something, somebody says, I don't see it. And you have to get somehow to a level of certitude that does not depend on the first person saying, I see it, and the second person saying, I don't see it. What are you going to do about that? Oh, I won't see it. Right. There's also that. So, again, I think that's all. That's exactly what discussion ought to go around. Now, no air defense for 1 hour and 45 minutes, right? From about 8:15 in the morning until 5 or maybe even 10 minutes after 10, there's no air defense. Remember the Cold War? The Soviet submarine was 5 minutes away, so you had to have everything up within 5 minutes, or you had to have it up already. But this time we get 1 hour and 45 minutes. Now, it is impossible for any group acting outside of the United States to carry out this. In other words, there is no way to paralyze air defense. And then we have the other area, I think, not so much of progress in research, but certainly there's a growing consensus, let's say, among people, right? We have David Ray Griffin hearing the tapes of the firemen and then becoming convinced that this was controlled demolition. Great. We have Stephen Jones writing a peer-reviewed paper. Interesting that it got through the peer review, right, of a learned journal, saying that this is controlled demolition. That's also good. I'm glad to see that various people in academia are coming further and further towards, I think, what is fairly obvious. Notice that this building is exploding. It is being destroyed in thin air. If you saw some recent cases of controlled demolition, they don't come down quite as fast as this, even when the buildings are much smaller. My impression is that there are energy sources here that may be at the very outer limits of conventional controlled demolition. In other words, if this is controlled demolition of the conventional type, it is one of the most robust, most brute force approaches to that I have ever seen. But what it obviously is not, with things, these huge pieces of debris, this is not simply a building collapsing, and we can look at that from a number of points of view. Here's the famous Interstate Insurance, I believe, in Los Angeles in 1988. It's about 50 stories, I believe, comparable building, burns for many hours, big fire, no collapse. I personally saw in Madrid last spring, I saw the Wellington, I believe the Wellington building in Madrid,
Windsor,
that had burned lustily for 48 hours or something like that, and had a couple of floors on the top collapse. But other than that, no. And of course, the key to the whole thing, look at these massive central columns of the building as it was going up, right? Look at these things. This is like the structure of a battleship. This is extremely strong. There's no energy source that they've ever mentioned that comes anywhere near cutting this into neat pieces. Their idiotic pancake theory says, well, the floor is pancaked down. Fine, the floor is pancaked down, but this will remain. It'll either remain or it'll fall over. But it's not going to cut itself into those neat pieces so that it all comes up in a nice pile like your Lincoln Logs or your Erector set there at the bottom. It's impossible. So the main target of controlled demolition necessarily has to be these central columns. And indeed, here it is. I have to thank Gerhard Wisniewski. He's written a wonderful book on 9/11. I saw him again in Brussels at the Axis of Peace. He's got new books out. Look at this. Here's the oxygen-starved black smoke from the fire, and here's some white smoke from squibs of smoke from what? From controlled demolition. And you can see how it evolves. That was number one. Number two, you can see that it's billowing up. You can see it billowing further. So, and it accompanies the shockwave of the fall of the building. Notice the squibs extend over two-thirds of the facade, which corresponds more or less to the key parameter, which is those central columns. In other words, the central columns seem to extend over about two-thirds of the building. And you get it, you know, huge pieces of rubble projected out 75, 100, 150 meters, whatever it is. And then the reductio ad absurdum of the whole thing, right? Building 7, never hit by an airplane, very small fires observed, 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the afternoon, and it comes down. And this, of course, is more in the mode of a classic controlled demolition, what you'd normally see. Next, please. And that's how you do it, right? That's the normal controlled demolition, right? The old-fashioned artisan forms. You make a lot of little holes, put in small charges at the key points in the static structure of the building, computer sets it off, down it comes. Although you see lately there are some cases where it hasn't quite worked. A couple of cases the past 6 months. So here's building one, here's building two, here's building seven. Notice it's quite a ways. And this one, I think, is what? Building six.
Yes.
And here we have this huge crater. What about this? Nobody seems to talk about this one.
I do.
You do? Wonderful.
Demolition trash. It's through 6 World Trade, just after I walked past in the north part of the complex. And went to the Times and the Journal of Day to me. I went to the Attorney General with it 6 weeks later. They ignored me. But yes, I've heard that demolition. And the excuse of the administration was because they had to say something that fuel from the first craft flowed into the basement of 6 World Trade Center and then spontaneously combusted the hazardous material stored there. And I said, that's clearly the manifest because the symmetry of the hole defies their excuse.
Well, very interesting. Anyway, there's another big anomaly that nobody's willing to talk about. And then, of course, this other one shows the molten metal found in the sub-basement level. What energy source that is explained in the official version could ever melt these huge quantities of metal that remain there for days and days and weeks and weeks? And why does this site smoke for so long? Partially because of this molten metal down there underneath. The Pentagon, again, the official version tells us that this is a Boeing. It can't be a Boeing. Here's the Pentagon. Here's the plane hitting at the indicated angle. And you can see the dimensions of the hole that the plane would have made. And they say, well, no, the wings crumpled back. Yeah, the wings maybe, but not these jet engines. They're the most massive part of the entire thing. And this would have created a very significant hole. The other problem is that this is now Hani Hanjour flying it. He has to come in at 1 centimeter off the grass. There are also barriers here, right? There are spools of industrial wire. There are light posts and so forth that are here. And he's got to do it. And of course, there's no sign of this rather large tail cutting into the building. This is the original hole taken by the first photographers on the scene. This is from Thierry Maison, great French expert who just organized a large conference in Brussels last November on a whole series of themes. And more, this is now the detail. So this is where the Boeing went. The whole fuselage and above all those outboard engines that are the most massive parts of the airplane. It's impossible. So the big verdict on the official version is it is physically absurd. It is impossible. Physically impossible in the real world that we know, anyway. Maybe they have some other one. Now, the media like to show you this kind of thing when there's a big hole because the facade collapsed as a result of the fire later in the day. And here's Ashcroft, remember him, mugging outside, right? Those were the good old days under Ashcroft. Now we have Gonzalez. And this now is the Shanksville crater. Another Boeing is alleged to have disappeared here. They say there's a mine. Well, then go into the mine and bring up the parts, and they can't do this. And I would have to say also that in the other one, the Pentagon one, they do come out with a handful of stuff. You could put it in a bushel basket, and there's a couple of rotors, but they're nowhere near big enough to represent the jet engines that were involved. Now, from my point of view, the biggest problem with the official version of 9/11 is something they refuse to talk about. The threat that was delivered to Bush through the Secret Service, Angel is next. In other words, we are going to shoot down the presidential plane. So I don't believe that Bush is told in advance. Who would tell Bush in advance? Bush is not important enough to be told in advance. Bush is simply a cretin who will do what he is told to do, and that's exactly what he did do. But he's not told in advance. There's no engraved invitation that comes in saying the honor of your presence is requested at a terrorist attack and you're supposed to do this, that, and the other thing. No, why would you tell him? You would not tell him. Cheney may be told more, but I don't think everything. The axiomatic point of view that I represent anyway is that the presidency and the vice presidency after Franklin D. Roosevelt at least are puppet institutions. They don't have real power because what we have here is not a dictatorship, it's an oligarchy. An oligarchy can be very nasty, as we'll see, as we're seeing, but it's not a dictatorship. That's maybe one of Bush's missteps. So this is an ultimatum, I believe, from the rogue network to Bush. And it's accompanied, well, it's a threat to attack Air Force One. That's why he has to go to Barksdale and Offutt. The threat involved is to say, Bush, you launch the war of civilizations in conventional form in Afghanistan, or else we'll launch it in nuclear form wherever we want. Cairo, Tehran, Amman, whatever it is, Islamabad, we'll start it in nuclear form. How can you do that? Because we have the codes. And here are some codes that we have. Here are some other codes that we have. So essentially, it's the threat of an assassination and a coup. Cheney can become president. Why not? Escalate the entire thing. And there's a lot more to be said about this. I urge you to read my chapter. There's what looks like a kind of a half-hearted attempt to assassinate Bush first thing in the morning on the day of, and so forth. And we have Buffett and Scowcroft at Offutt Air Force Base. So it's a threatening call that comes in with a broad array of code words indicating that the people making the call have access to the top levels of the main agencies of the U.S. government. The rogue network speaks. This is the moment where the rogue network speaks. Now, a lot of people have speculated, you know, is he the cat who ate the canary? Saying, oh, I've done it, I'm winning. I don't see that at all. I see pure terror. I see a pathetic little man who is caught in a situation that he cannot comprehend, and he's looking at, and Fleischer is holding up this thing saying, don't say anything, and he doesn't. And he says, I sat there and projected power. That's the modern idea of the presidency, is that it's a ceremonial post where you project power. But what, of course, he doesn't do is he doesn't say, call out the fighters, call out the Coast Guard, call out, call out, call out. No crisp orders, no commander-in-chief, right? You could impeach him just for this. Yeah. Or you could have defeated him. Kerry could have defeated him in the campaign, saying, why didn't you get up and do something instead of sitting there for 10 minutes? But I would say, though, that the difference is that in the course of the day, he capitulates. He says, what is it that they want me to do? I'm going to do it, of course. And since then, he has become the most important public spokesman, right? He is the main salesman of the myth. He's the one who pronounces the myth, and he returns to it and reinforces it. But it doesn't mean that he knew anything. I always found the bumper sticker Bush knew, contradiction in terms, can't know anything, can't know anything. How about this? In May of last year, small plane approaches Washington, Congress evacuated, White House evacuated, everybody evacuated, Bush not told. Out riding his bike. Same thing. He's a puppet. He's a puppet. He'll do what he's told. But it's an important point, because if you have a Bush-Cheney approach to this thing, you get rid of them and your invisible government is still there. You haven't solved anything permanently. Now, a couple of things about the recent events. The National Security Agency wiretaps, okay? These came out in the New York Times on December 16th. December 19th, Bush had a press conference. He invoked September 11th, myth, 8 times in less than 5 minutes. Now, this by itself is enough to silence those who say, oh, September 11th is dead as an issue. Don't care about September 11th. Forget about September 11th. Nonsense. September 11th is the heart of the matter. Always has been. And it shows, with Bush is pulling the myth out now more than once a day. He's taking the myth and shaking it in the face of his critics. I think this increases the possibility that the myth can be debunked and discarded, because he's using it all the time. And at the Axis for Peace in Brussels, my good friend Phil Berg came forward and he said, what we need is a 9/11 deep throat. We need somebody who was part of this to come forward and testify under, obviously, security precautions. There's also this question. Maybe you ask yourself, The FISA court, right, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, they will put a wiretap on a ham sandwich. You don't need, it's just pro forma, right? You fill in the blanks and you send it over and you've got a wiretap, right, for any of us. So why does Bush insist on not going to the FISA court? Why does he get, you know, extra trouble? Who needs it? Why not go to the FISA court for everything you need? My approach is, and again, you have to know about 9/11 in order to see this, is that what he's trying to cover up is that many of the intercepts have to do with 9/11 cover-up, and therefore with 9/11, and or the running of ongoing terrorism, such as Madrid 04, London 05, and so forth. Because the National Security Agency in Fort Meade is this vacuum cleaner, right? And it brings in everything. And if you go through with a computer according to code words, look what pops out. You don't want a judge seeing it. And therefore, as soon as you get a judge into the act, there's somebody that you probably works for you, but maybe not. So I think this is why he did not do the obvious. Now, I don't know if this has been noticed. This is from the Washington Post. Bear with me, got some quotes. Remember, there was a 9/11 resolution on September 14, 2001, the new Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And the first request that Bush made was to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States. That was Bush's original request. It's a declaration of war against the world. You do anything you want as long as you want. It's rejected. It's too broad, right? This is Senator Daschle writing it. Now, the Congress says, no, no, we won't give you that. We'll give you all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons the President determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the 9/11 attacks. Somewhat narrower. Because Bush is trying to say, you gave me the authority to wiretap all I wanted. Right? You gave it to me. And the Daschle is trying to say, no, no, we didn't. Now, here's what Bush comes back with. At the last minute, Bush says, I want you to authorize all necessary and appropriate force in the United States and against those nations, organizations, or persons the President determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the 9/11 actions. Now that's civil war. Why does he want that? Why does he want force inside the United States? Well, it's a coup. And it's either there's going to be a coup and he wants to defend himself with military force against a coup, possible, but more likely, he's going to have a coup, there's going to be a coup, and there may be unreliable military units. There may be some units that might fight. So he's got to have, by what authority do you wage civil war against that mountain division in upstate New York that refuses to follow the new coup? Well, I'm doing that because I have this. Did anybody notice? I mean, to me, this is absolutely critical stuff in terms of Bush's mentality right after September 11th. And again, this is Senator Daschle writing in saying, we never gave him the power to do phone taps inside the country. Now, brief excursus. Based on all of this stuff, the 9/11 research community has divided into a number of points of view. And I want to just briefly acquaint you with those. There is, of course, the official version. Right? If you want that, right? You can have it. It's a tissue of lies. It's discredited. It's even more discredited now with Able Danger, because we know that there was vital information from, you know, government officials that they absolutely ignored. Not historically relevant, they said. Now, there's also the official version with unanswered questions. I think Nafiz Ahmed's latest book. Now, also, I'm trying to be fair. It may look like I'm polemical, but I am trying to be fair. If people disagree, we can talk about it later. There is then the official version, and you deserve it because of imperialism, right? You imperialists, you get what you deserve. You had it coming. Damn you. Blowback, exactly.
It's you here.
Huh?
You the people, or...
You, the Americans, you, the we'll take an example. I think Chomsky is this, basically, Gore Vidal. I think the person who has done most to hurt the movement in the year 2005 is this guy Ward Churchill, who turns out to be a former weatherman. He came back from Vietnam after being in some kind of special forces. He knew explosives. He taught the weathermen how to build bombs, with the result that you saw over here in the early 70s when a brownstone blew up and the Mad Dog faction of the weathermen blew themselves up in that building. He was their teacher. You know what his line is? He says, "The people who died were little Eichmanns." Now, this is wrong. It's not true. It's also politically insane. And then he has the capper. He says, "If you don't believe in the official version, you're a racist." Yeah, why? Because you're saying that Arabs are inferior and couldn't organize that whole complicated operation. And I'm not kidding. That's what he says. If you don't accept the official version, you're a racist. So I put him in for the Arlen Specter Award for the greatest imagination shown in dishing up ruling class lies. Ward Churchill. And a lot of academics have a weakness for him because they see him as fighting for academic freedom. I think it's a big mistake. Find somebody better than Ward Churchill. Then we have LIHOP, Let It Happen on Purpose. And we'll see what the difference is. It implies that there really is Al-Qaeda, and that what the U.S. government did was to lower its guard, so to speak. The Cheney network helped it happen on purpose. And this has been ably argued by Mike Ruppert in his many books. And then we have Ian Henschel in that book that I mentioned. They call themselves LIHOP Forte. Now, are we going? Now, I said before, I believe in truth and labeling. I represent my hop. This is Made It Happen on Purpose. On this one, David Ray Griffin, of course, has an eminent place in the research with the new Pearl Harbor omissions and distortions. Every detailed question that he gets, he seems to argue in the direction of my hop. But he is an agnostic as to what happened. He always says, "I believe there was controlled demolition, but as to what happened in general, I don't know." So he is an agnostic on the overarching questions, unless that has changed more recently. Most of the Europeans are U.S. secret government MIHOP from the word go. Maison, von Bülow, Wisniewski, Blondet of Italy, Hufschmidt in this country, I think, would fit that, and myself. There is also another version called Mossad. I called it Mossad MIHOP. The people who endorse this will say, "Americans would never do that to other Americans, therefore some foreign force had to do it, therefore the Mossad." I think this is wrong. I think this is absurd and it cannot be maintained by the evidence. You could probably make a better case for MI6 MIHOP, that the British secret intelligence had a bigger role, because they demonstrably do have a role, which for the Mossad is much, much harder to prove. That's von Bülow, former Deputy Defense Minister of Germany. That's his book. Next, please. That's Maison. The first book in the world, I think, is his, in September of 01. That's Wisniewski. I have to make a special appeal. Wisniewski came to Brussels and had a leaflet that he's looking for a publisher. Any publishers here, there's a great book to put out. Highly, it's from 2003, but in many ways it is the most timely book of all, in some ways at least. This is Blondet for the Italians, right? Here's Italian readers. This is 11th of September, coup d'etat in the United States. Maurizio Blondet. The author is a right-of-center Catholic, interestingly enough. Now, there's a whole bunch of evidence. I won't go through this. Here's what we'll do. Because of the time consideration, there's no point in trying to read all these things for you, right? You can look at it. If you really want this show, I'm sure that the managers will be able to deliver it, probably for some kind of a conventional service fee or whatever it is. So I can leave it with them and then you can get it, so you don't have to sit here taking notes. There's a lot of evidence that points to LIHOP. Now the difference is, if you go with LIHOP, your point of view is that Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, Atta, and so forth, that they exist independently and do have the physical technical capability to produce the results observed. The most extreme defense of this I've heard is that Yes, Atta is a double agent. Yes, they're double agents. But what they did was they were running drugs for the U.S. government. They were actually doing drug running, and they got tired of being bossed around by the U.S. government, so they decided to get together and pull one on their employers by going to terrorism, which was not part of the CIA plan. I think it's a weak entry, but you will hear it. Now, MIHOP asserts that the patsies accused by the government do not have the physical technical capability, and that government officials are the perpetrators, that the terrorism comes from the government. And now I want to try to show you how. Here's MIHOP evidence, right? The Global Hawk, I think, still controlled demolition, Silverstein saying to pull it. In the last couple of days, Silverstein comes out saying, oh, I meant time to get the firemen out of the building. Problem with that is there were no firemen in that building. They had been pulled out long before, as far as anybody knows. Problems and anomalies with the flying objects, no commercial aircraft at the Pentagon, Shanksville impossible, Angel is next, okay? All of that would point to MIHOP. However, notice that MIHOP includes LIHOP. Sometimes people come forward, I don't know, Sybil Edmonds, some people say, don't listen to her, she's LIHOP. Yeah, wait, she's telling what she knows. What she sees is she happens to work in an FBI bureau whose job is LIHOP. If she worked someplace else, she might tell you something that looked more like MIHOP. But there's a division of labor, in other words, right? There's a division of labor, so some government agencies do things that are consistent with LIHOP. Now, I don't want to spend time on this, but there's a red herring in all of this stuff, which is peak oil. I have to say briefly that I think this is a fraud propagated by the oil cartel itself. I know it's controversial. I remember the fake oil crisis of 1979, too. The 1973 one, they were all frauds. There never was an introduction of supply. It was all done in the trading pits over here, the COMEX or the 9X or whatever they call it. Lord Victor Rothschild in those days worked for Royal Dutch Shell Research. They had this other guy, King Hubbert, working at the U.S. branch. And they brought it out at the Bilderberger meeting in Saltsjöbaden, Sweden, in the spring of 1973, that there was going to be an oil crisis and that they could all get rich. They could have a speculative orgy in the trading pits and get the price up 400%. Later on, they did the same thing with Khomeini. And the main person now supposedly predicting peak oil is somebody who has made these predictions several times in the past. So he seems to be somehow the boy who cried wolf. Let's leave it behind. Let's just remember, though, that when you're dealing with oil, you're dealing with an extremely cartelized system with these companies now dominating it. And that none other than Alan Greenspan, in a speech in Tokyo last October, essentially said, yeah, the price of oil is going to keep going up. Sounds like peak oil. Sounds like Greenspan endorses peak oil. And I think that is the main issue. I think we're in a world financial crisis with $300 trillion in derivatives. Should we blame the world population or should we blame the financiers? I blame the financiers. They should pay. They're responsible, not the average person. There's also the other question, since we're talking about the attack on Iran. On the 20th of March, Iran will open the Iranian oil bourse with trading denominated in euros. This is the beginning of the end of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency imposed on the world. This absurd and obsolete status that they've had that allows the U.S. to control everybody's oil, to skim off the top of world trade, is now coming to an end. And I think it's important that this be done peacefully. This is not your interest at stake. This is these Wall Street guys. Right? It's not your purchasing power at all. But one of the reasons that they're so hot to attack Iran is because there's this 20th of March launch for the Iranian oil exchange where the trading will be done not in dollars, but in euros. It's a very complicated issue. I hope we can talk about it maybe later. Now, my theme for the rest of the talk, and I'll try to go through this. Let me just ask the management. How long can we continue?
You can go as long as you like.
Okay, fine.
You can go as long as you like, and also apparently it's fine with the microphone.
Wonderful.
Just try not to get too loud, because they might end up hearing it in the middle of the theater piece. But it's been fabulous so far.
Let me just point out to this. My argument is that the terrorism is conducted through military drills and terror drills, and this is what the average person must learn. This is why the my hop is not just, you know, I like Miller Lite and you like Heineken's. No, no. It's absolutely crucial, because if you don't see it this way, you can't tell what's coming and you can't fight it. If I believe in unanswered questions or lie hop, I'm essentially leading you like lambs to the slaughter. Whereas what I'm calling on you to do is to activate yourselves to fight against this $500 billion plus apparatus. Now, we're entering the world of drills, maneuvers, war games, exercises, simulations. Okay? And they have all this jargon, mainly to deceive. Command post exercise, CPX, staff exercise, simulation, tabletop, sandbox. The main difference is that some of these drills are done electronically or with models or in rooms with committees, whereas in others, you have real planes, real tanks, real troops moving around. And then you have the terror drills, which are supposedly different, but you'll see that one becomes the other relatively easily. Now, the purpose of drills is inseparable from deception in many cases. The classic one is, I'm the Prime Minister of Fredonia. It's time to have our summer drill. So I'm deploying my 10 divisions of Fredonian army troops to the border of neighboring Slobovia. The Slobovian media says, what is this? And I say, of course, this is merely our regular, peaceful, defensive summer drill for our troops. So the 10 divisions get along the Slobovian border. I give the order. They attack, surprise attack, and it succeeds. That's the essence of a drill, to deceive the other side. But now, can we go back?
Let's try.
Right? Without... Okay? Now, the other kind of drill is to deceive your own side through a coup d'etat. And it can be done also because you're conduiting an operation through the bureaucracy. But not everybody agrees with you. Some do, but some don't, or some may not. And the ones who don't agree with you might try to oppose you. So you've got to be ready for that. So what you do is you conduit it through with a legal drill, with a legal name established, and because of need to know and compartmentalization, you can make sure that the people who might oppose you don't find out about it until it has already happened. Here's the classic case. We have a loyal officer here. We have a coup traitor here, terrorist coup traitor sitting here. So the loyal officer looks over and he says, hey, wow, crashing planes into buildings, what's that? And the traitor can then say, hey, wait a minute, that's Amalgam Virgo 01. And by the way, you don't have a clearance for that, so don't ask me any more questions. There it is in a nutshell, because these guys sit at consoles and one group doesn't know what the other group is doing. So drills can be used as this kind of a cover. One definition of a coup d'etat is one part of the government attacks other parts of the government. That's what a coup is. Right? One part is witting, organized, determined. The other part is unorganized, not knowing. So government, yes, but not the whole government. A part of it. The problem is when you look backwards, it looks like they all did it, because if the coup succeeds, they all pretend they were part of it from the very beginning, and they all say, yeah, right, terrorism. Let's go get those terrorists. So we can, you can use this also to fool dupes and fanatics. One classic is a dupe is recruited for a drill. He may be told it's a drill. He may be told it's just a job. He's asked to do it. And then something blows up, and he's a terrorist. Something like that, I think, London, July 7th of last year. So when you're dealing with these drills, there is what I call the ghostly objectivity. You get to this, you say, is it a dream or reality? Is it a drill or is it killing and war? And it goes back and forth. Because when they design the drills, they say, we want to make these drills as authentic as possible. We want to have the greatest possible degree of fidelity. Yeah, the greatest possible degree of fidelity is people really die. Next. Now, Nico Haupt, I believe, in the room. Back in the summer at the Truth Convergence in Washington, he said, my terminology is too poor. That there are types of patsies. I say patsies, dupes, fanatics. He says, let's have more differentiated terminology from the lower levels of awareness to the higher. You have toys are dupes who do not even know they're in a drill. You have team players or extras who think they're in a drill. Supervisors, coordinators, and consultants, some of them think they're in a drill, some of them know it's a real attack. Passive plotters, they know the attack is real, but they are also susceptible to being liquidated by higher-up masterminds, MI5, MI6, Tavistock Institute. That was the London case. So anyway, in that sense, 9/11 is not just the day of the drills, it's the day of the dupes. Apologies to Cardinal Richelieu. So, part of the government attacks the other part, and the part that's been attacked either falls in or they get machine gunned. And it never came anywhere near that, because that would take some courage, right?
Can I ask a question?
Very briefly.
Paul Wolfowitz, who was Deputy Secretary
yes.
of Defense, suddenly
right.
disappeared.
Oh, no, he didn't.
Wait,
you
no,
can...
and he went to work for the World Bank.
Right.
Was he pushed out? And what
the question is just a brief question about Wolfowitz and what happened to him. I think he was moved out because he was a lightning rod for attacks. He was very controversial. He was also a failure. And remember, the World Bank job, you can kill many more people at the World Bank than you ever could at the Pentagon. It's incomparably more. And we remember McNamara. McNamara killed millions in Vietnam, but when you the World Bank, it gets up to the tens of millions, the hundreds of millions, over many, many decades.
Still alive, McNamara.
Yeah, he still is. Now, if you want to learn about 9/11, at this point, I would say, don't start reading books about, you know, the history of Saudi Arabia. Afghanistan doesn't help you at all. This is an interesting book. William Arkin, Code Names. Now, of course, he's an NBC consultant, writes for the Washington Post. He has an interesting column called Early Warning. We need have no illusions about Mr. Arkin, okay? He's not one of us. This is a limited hangout, but in an area where you're dealing with this tremendous cascade of code names, it's good to have a basic map, right? You can't tell the agents without a program. Okay, here's the program. Now, this is the concept that I most want you to try to absorb. If you want to have a successful terrorist action, you're going to want to, and if it's really ambitious, right? A simple assassination may not require this, but something really big like 9/11 generally does. You're going to want to use government resources to do it. You're going to want to conduct it, pass it through the government military security bureaucracy. What you want to do is to design a drill that looks, on the whole, very, very much like the terrorist operation that you want to carry out. And then, small changes will change the drill into a real massacre and an attack. So you camouflage your criminal intent, you allow the terrorist provocation to be staged through a series of seemingly minor departures from the drill scenario. And again, you look at these things and you say, well, wait a minute, where does simulation end and reality begin? Here in the city, we had gas dispenser drills back in August. I had the honor of being on WBAI to tell people that this was a bad thing. They said, oh, we have gas dispensers in Midtown Manhattan last August. We're dispensing a purely inert gas. They said it's a gas that will remain down in the crevices for 3,000 years, but forget about that part, right? The simple stuff. Gas dispensers to see which way the wind will blow the poison gas if somebody comes in with poison gas. Now, wait a minute. All you have to do is have one rogue government operative come in and say, let's take out that inert gas, whatever that is, and let's put in potassium cyanide, and then you have a real massacre. So to get to my points of later on, you want to shut these things down. You don't want those things. Those are only there to terrorize people. They cost a fortune. They're damaging to your health even if nothing happens. And if something does happen, it's a mass slaughter. So no drills. We don't want drills. Drills should be called off. We have better things to do with resources. Couple of examples now. Operation Mongoose. This was the CIA's plan to kill Castro of Cuba, and I think it's generally accepted by the Kennedy assassination researchers that Operation Mongoose was indeed used to cover at least part of the activities that killed President Kennedy. this was one of my discoveries was in 1981 when Reagan was shot. It turned out that in the day following the hit on Reagan, there was a presidential succession exercise scheduled for the following day called Nine Lives. And this, to me, means, to me anyway, that significant parts of the attack on Reagan were conducted under the cover of the Nine Lives. And they said, yeah, we have Hinckley, he's a Yale dropout that we got him here, and he's going to pretend to be the actor. You'll see actors will come on the scene soon enough.
And his father knew Bush.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, I go through all of my past research. Of course, we have to know that Neil Bush was in intimate contact with Scott Hinckley and his wife. They were going to have dinner the night after this assassination was scheduled to have taken place. So if they had actually had the dinner, it would have been on the day after Reagan had been killed and Bush Sr. had become president. That's in my other book on George Bush. So when you get these things, whenever you see these things saying, gosh, what a weird coincidence, what kind of a strange happenstance, that's when you have to ask yourself, wait a minute, this is real. This is a less known one. In 1975, after the fall of Saigon, some people in Washington and Wall Street thought that the U.S.-British strategic position in the world was simply going to collapse. You know, the domino theory coming true. Why? Could have happened. So they said, why don't we then have a simulated confrontation under the code name HILEX 75, high-level exercise, with top officials, and the option is, goes real, turns into a real confrontation with the Soviets to try to force them back and somehow redress the balance of this colossal defeat in Southeast Asia for the U.S. Now, the German news magazine Spiegel put out a leak, and there was a mobilization of citizens. I can tell you, on New Year, on Christmas Eve, 1975, I was in Milan, Italy, handing out leaflets in front of the Milan Cathedral saying, stop HILEX 75. It's going to be a real nuclear confrontation. Here's another interesting one. Abel Archer, 83, after the shootdown of the South Korean airliner in the Far East, after the deployment of the Euro missiles in Europe, there was a U.S. nuclear war drill called Abel Archer that had a very high degree of fidelity. And the Soviets looked at it and said, my God, it's the real thing. And they went to top nuclear alert. So it meant that the world was on the brink of nuclear war, real danger. Because the Soviets know all this stuff, knew it then, that the purpose of a drill is often to mask something real. Back in July 7th, we had the amazing story of three drills. Atlantic Blue of the British, Top Off 3 of the US, and Triple Play of Canada. All with the same scenario. Bombs in the London Underground at the same time as an international conference. That would be the Glen Eagles Group of Eight. And we also had, that was generally, right? That had happened some months before. On the day of, Visor Associates with Peter Power were drilling bombs in the underground at the places and times approximately of the actual explosions, said BBC 5 on July 7th. And we also have the fact that Scotland Yard knew and told Netanyahu. Some people think this is, you know, this shows that Netanyahu is bad. Yes, Netanyahu is bad, but that from this we don't learn that Netanyahu is bad. We learn that Scotland Yard is bad. My God, they're the ones who knew and told Netanyahu. They have nothing to learn from Netanyahu, I guarantee you.
Giuliani was there also.
But it's, again, the key thing is that Scotland Yard is telling them, the police know that the bomb is going to go off. Now, let's just look at this. We're going to have to skip over some details for the sake of everybody's blood sugar. But these are 15-plus drills. This could go up to 20, depending on how you want to count this. On the morning of September 11th, the greatest density of drills ever. Why? What a coincidence. Oh, there is one version that says that the intelligence, Al-Qaeda intelligence, had penetrated the Pentagon and found out when all this was going to happen, and therefore they knew when to attack. And that's just ridiculous. I mean, if you believe that, I don't know what I can do for you. Right? It's like having, if the head of a terrorist organization works for the FBI, it doesn't mean the terrorist organization has taken over the FBI. It means the FBI has taken over the terrorist organization, right? I hope we're all on the same page.
And here's my thesis, that the main aspects of 9/11 were indeed prepared, drilled in advance by war drills and terror drills. They were carried out that way in large part. And the drills are inherently suspect in our time, $500 billion a year, because those are the likely vehicles for terror attacks. And I'm calling you to vigilance. Now, if you look at my book, my book has, the first edition of this has 7 drills. And I'm already had, Ruppert only had 5 drills. But now we're up to 15. Now, here's Vigilant Guardian. Supposedly a command post exercise. But the personnel involved, they're told, oh, there's a hijacked plane. And one of the people said, oh, God, that must be part of the drill. So obviously it lowers the state of readiness. But she also watches a simulated hijacked plane heading for JFK in New York City on the morning of 9/11. So the question is that a real plane or a fake radar blip inserted onto the screen? Could be either one. And if it's a real plane, then we get into the area of, well, if planes hit the towers, what planes were they? Were they planes that had been replaced? Right? Again, it opens up a tremendous can of worms, because then what happened to the passengers and all that? But perfectly possible, the one thing this does do is multiply the number of targets. Now let's push ahead. Vigilant Warrior, mentioned by Myers in Richard Clark's book, and that's really all we know, all that I know anyway. Like to know more. That could be very important. Northern Vigilance, as a drill, sending fighters north to Alaska and Canada during a Russian bomber exercise around the North Pole. This also includes fake blips injected onto radar screens for them to go chasing after. That's a drill. Northern Guardian. Is that another drill? These are all drills taking place on the morning of September 11th. So this is another one. Is this connected to Northern Vigilance? Anyway, as a result of this, the bureaucracy, according to numerous pieces of evidence, thought they were dealing with 29 aircraft reported hijacked on the morning of 9/11. So the effect of the drills is to take the fighter planes out of the Northeast United States, send them to Alaska, northern Canada, and indeed Iceland, as we're going to see in a minute, and multiplies the number of targets. You can imagine generals designing this. Say, yeah, we'll reduce the number of assets and we'll multiply the number of targets, and that way we won't have any trouble. Because there always is a danger that somebody may decide to start shooting and interrupt your plan. I would never say, no U.S. fighter pilot, God, no, I wouldn't say it. But you might find a U.S. fighter pilot who would disobey orders. You might find a U.S. fighter pilot who would overrule his orders and decide to shoot down something like this. Now, here's Operation Northern Guardian. This is beyond drills now. This is something real. This applies to 9/11 specifically. It's a real defense against Russia. 6 planes from Langley Air Force Base in Virginia were sent to Keflavik, Iceland to patrol the sort of the northern Atlantic front. Okay? So we have some planes are being moved for drills, some planes are being moved for something real. Northern Watch.
Can I ask, where do you have the Iceland? I've never heard that.
This is, I have to thank Paul Thompson and Cooperative Research. You want to check in there every couple of months, because he's always got pieces coming in from people, and that's part of it. Operation Northern Watch. Now, this is another one, real. This is the no-fly zone in northern Iraq. So 6 planes from Langley Air Force Base were there. The result of these last two things is that Langley Air Force Base normally has about 18 planes. Now they only have 6. See? And this is just the beginning. September 5th. U.S. Army bases start full access control. Now that applies especially to Fort McNair and Fort Myers. Got it wrong. Typing in the train. Bad idea.
It's there. Is it?
Okay, Fort Myer and Fort McNair. Good. They're both there. These are two bases. If you want to have a coup in Washington, you have to control those two bases. If you have any loyal divisions, loyal brigades, loyal regiments, you got to make sure they're there. So September 5th, U.S. Army bases start full access control. MPs check everybody coming in and going out. Apparently all Army bases. Why? What's going on? terror alert? Maybe, but maybe more. Here's another one. Amalgam Warrior. These are all on 9/11. This is NORAD again. Live fly air defense, air intercept tracking surveillance. Now this is defending against strategic bombers. Stealth bombers, B-1s, maybe B-52s with F-18s. So there's another drill that's going on. Takes up planes. We've also got Atlantic City Air Force Base closed after 1997 in the middle of the emergency. Somebody says, call Atlantic City Air Force Base and tell them to scramble fighters. And the answer is, no longer exists. Budget cuts. Andrews Air Force Base fighters have been sent to North Carolina. And Otis, this is Cape Cod, their fighters have been sent out over the Atlantic. So there's a general tendency to move all the assets as far away from the action as you can. Now this indicates, of course, that the command structure is full of complicit elements, or they have the upper hand at the moment. Here's yet another one, Crown Vigilance. This is an air combat command exercise. So this would be going on inside the committee. Another one, Apollo Guardian. Now this is the Space Command. Not given to know for us mortals what the details of this was, but detail was, but happening on 9/11. Here's an interesting one. The head of NORAD, or one of the heads of NORAD, says, let's take two AWACS planes, you know, the planes with the revolving radar screen on top. Two AWACS planes, he says, just my personal initiative. Let's have an exercise simulating an attack on the United States for September 11th. And let's have one off the coast of Florida, where Bush is, and one off the coast of Washington, D.C., for obvious reasons.
That was on 11th?
That's on September 11th. So they think they're going into a drill, and then they find it's not a drill. Again, the ghostly objectivity kicks in for them. They're told it's going to be a drill of an attack, and then they have to tell them, it really is an attack. This is also, I think, part of a coup. In other words, if anybody had resisted, this would be part of the way to take it further. Fort Myer, Virginia, they're having a special aircraft crash refresher course for firefighters attached to the base. And these, of course, are the people who are 3 minutes away from the Pentagon. So they get over there and fix the crime scene. In other words, they're obviously told what to do, cordon off the crime scene, make sure that no evidence gets found. They're also doing a force protection exercise later in the week. They had prepared with a mass casualty drill, Port Belvoir, same area, July 2001. It's all focusing, all honing in on 9/11. Here's another one. Fort Belvoir has a garrison-controlled exercise with emergency rescue techniques on September 11th. Well, where is the CIA, FBI, anti-terrorist task force? The special group that should be guarding against this kind of thing. They are on a training exercise in Monterey, California. So they've been sent about as far away as they could normally hope to get. And of course, here in New York, we have Giuliani in his self-serving book, Leadership, telling us about Tripod 2. It was already known in 2002. So this is biochemical attack and distribution of medication. They had already had Red X recognition, evaluation, and decision-making in May 11, 2001. That's supposedly a tabletop biological warfare drill. And of course, here is somebody who knows what's going to happen because he said, they told me to evacuate my command post because the buildings were going to come down. Nobody else got told. And also in your area, Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, timely alert 2, disaster drill to test emergency response capability. Morning of September 11th, and again, the ghostly objectivity. They're told it's happening, and then they pretend to be upset, and then they really are upset because it really is real. They had done the same thing a little bit earlier with a real bomb that turned out to be a training aid. This time, the training aid turned out to be a real massacre. So look, you have the paralysis of air defense by sending the aircraft far away. You have fake radar blips to sow confusion. You have real aircraft and real drones to act out hijackings. And then we have the degrees of fidelity. The big thing is when the drill goes live, it becomes an actual terror event with only small changes. And there are multiple levels of dupes and witting, but this is only the beginning. Now, Amalgam Virgo 01 has always seemed to me to be one of the really interesting ones, because this is now multiple simultaneous hijackings, quite similar to what you saw. 4-01, now this was held, this is not the day of anymore. This is a couple of months in advance. This sit in the Atlantic. And it's going to be either a cruise missile or an NQM-107 drone. Now that's what happened at the Pentagon. Some unmanned aerial vehicle, cruise missile, whatever it is, hit the Pentagon. So that's what they've already tested. And what they're preparing, I'm sorry, this must be 2002. Make that July 2002. They're preparing simulated hijacks of planes coming from Utah and Washington that are going to be made to go and land in British Columbia and Alaska. And I put that this is a big MIHOP point. Just further detail on that. Here we go. It's 2002. In the one from Salt Lake City, you're going to have the following cast. Delta pilots, real Delta pilots, actors posing as passengers, and they're going to fly from Utah to Hawaii. It was going to be hijacked by FBI agents posing as terrorists. Now think. Where are they going to hire these actors? You're going to go to the actors, what is it, Actors Equity, you're going to go to Central Casting? Where do you get them? You go to Al-Qaeda? Where do you get them? You go to some group of people like, you know, Able Danger. Able Danger says, yeah, we have a stable of these guys. You can have some of ours. And then it's going to be hijacked by FBI agents posing as terrorists. Government agents posing as terrorists. It's Mohammed Atta. He's a government agent posing as a terrorist, isn't he? Except then he becomes one. You see what I mean?
Yep.
Is it reality? Is it a drill? Or is it real killing? It becomes real when they start killing people. But that's Amalgam Virgo for June 2002. So think of all the permutations and combinations you can have. With that, the FBI told Seymour Hersh that they were simulating terrorist attacks, including multiple plane hijackings, all the time. Not just this, all the time. Some of them were apparently quite similar to the 9/11 attacks, says Paul Thompson. Good. Near Shanksville, can't forget that. June of 01, just a couple of weeks in advance, they have 600 first responders in a mall drilling biochemical attack. And they set them up with teams. I think the main thing here is, this is not the Pentagon, right? This is the middle of nowhere. So the plane is going to come down. People are going to go there. The local newsman is going to go there. You've got to make sure this local newsman doesn't get anywhere near it. You have got to cordon off that site. And I take it that, you know, biochemical, what are you going to do? Cordon off the site. So I think this is a preparation for Shanksville. This is in Westmoreland County. They didn't quite get the right county. Somerset County. Anyway, there's some problems with this argument I recognize, but at least it's suggested.
Murtha was involved with that drill.
Was he?
Congressman Murtha.
Yes, well, he's a big separate issue all in his own right.
Yeah.
Okay, now we get into the most blatant of them all. The National Reconnaissance Office. Right? The National Reconnaissance Office is a consortium of all the spooks. And they say, here's the headline, they were going to simulate a plane crash into their building on September 11th. A weird happenstance. National Reconnaissance Office, Chantilly, Virginia, emergency response, 3,000 employees sent home. Booz Allen Hamilton is in the picture. Watch out for them. Need I say more? And were they really sent home? Now, this is the Satellite Imaging Bureau, right? So they can see it all. You don't have to listen to these people saying they couldn't see it on their radar because the NORAD radar looked out. But what? So look down with the satellites and see it all in real time from above, right? They can see all that. Same thing with NORAD. Now, these two may be the same thing. Between 91 and 2001, they were simulating planes into buildings. Between 99 and 2001, they did it, including the World Trade Center, using numerous types of civilian and military aircraft. Some of these were coming from abroad. So they really prepare it, right? This is well prepared, nothing left to chance.
You think this is computers or
I don't know. If it's command post exercise, it's computers.
But then that's, again, it looks like a computer, but then, you know, sometimes the plug in to the Global Hawk is there. Sometimes not. Yeah. Right. Sandbox, whatever you call it. All right. The Pentagon has their own plane crash drill repeatedly in October 2000. This is the burning model airplane in a Pentagon model. Then they have continuity of government, meaning dictatorship. Continuity of government is going to be drilled on in April of 2001, but this is called off for various reasons. They have medics training for a 757 hitting the Pentagon. They have secret Pentagon police drills, and then in August of 2001, they have a mass casualty exercise based on a plane hitting the building. Now, they're well prepared, I think, because the intent here is to minimize the damage beyond the absolute necessary to make the public point that we didn't do it. Right? You attack the Pentagon, how can you accuse the Pentagon? Would they attack themselves? Clearly not. I know for a fact that once the Italian Interior Ministry in Rome organized a bomb attack on itself in order to gain public sympathy. So this would not be the first time. This is now Richard Clark, right, the darling of the Democratic Party, is planning to have a plane crash into the White House in 1998 with a tabletop exercise. His idea was a Learjet packed with explosives. We're getting to the end. There he is, right? Your government failed you, and I failed you, and somehow he's the hero of the Democratic Party. This is the kind of bureaucrat who would run the country under martial law, as indeed he ran it on 9/11. He ran the country on 9/11, make no mistake. Then we have a chemical weapons jet. These are just little... Now, this is all nothing. On the cover of my book, I don't have any buildings crashing. I don't have any Pentagon burning. I have a mushroom cloud. My book is the most thermonuclear strategic of all the books. It's the only one that mentions the Bush-Putin phone conversation of 9/11 that you may have forgotten about. There's the mushroom cloud. Now, the reason for this is that the horror of 9/11 that you saw pales in comparison to the part that could easily have happened that didn't happen. The other thing that's going on September 11th in the morning is that the U.S. is on total thermonuclear warfare alert. Yes, Your Honor, like whatever you had during the Cuban Missile Crisis, whatever you had during the Berlin Crisis, whatever you had during the Kippur War in 1973, you've got it. There's an Armageddon exercise going on. STRATCOM, Strategic Air Command, Strategic Command, Offutt Air Force Base. The issue is thermonuclear warfighting, strategic bombers, land-based missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And it's going on in the morning. And in my mind, this documents the thermonuclear options built into 9/11. What were they? Scowcroft is going out there to be part of the exercise. We probably shouldn't pay too much attention to him. So it's everything, as you see. All the branches of the strategic triad are loaded. There are B-52s and B-1s in the air loaded with hydrogen bombs. They're flying around like they used to do in the Cold War but have not done. And you've got these flying command posts mobilized, the Doomsday. They have different names at different times. Doomsday, Night Watch, or Looking Glass. You may know them under different code names. You have a full Cold War confrontation posture on the morning of 9/11. These Air Force bases involved, right? Notice two of them visited by Bush. He goes to Barksdale first. That's the number two in order in terms of authority. And then he goes to Offutt, where the real authority is. Part of this, according to Masson, he speculates that when the Angel is Next call comes in, it's clear that these people could launch nuclear war. So Bush's handlers tell him, you go to the Air Force base, you sit in the command center, and then we won't have to worry about codes coming in, because you can sit there and say, I'm the president. You can't launch the war without me. I don't care what codes you get. I'm sitting here. So he wants to take physical possession of the nuclear forces. Now, here's Global Guardian. It's an Armageddon exercise. It involves a red team acting as enemy agents, including attempts to penetrate the command using the internet and, above all,
a bad insider who had access to a key command and control system. Think what it means. The drill has a rogue element who's trying to launch the missiles. Again, change the dial one point, right? And it becomes a rogue operative who can launch the missiles. In other words, my view is that's the back door through which, if anything else failed, if the codes failed, the rogue network could have launched the nuclear missiles on the day of. Okay? And then there's also other stuff going on. You can look, cooperative research, Thompson has it, it's from a defense-related magazine. Right? This is insiders, right? Obviously, there are no official statements. Now remember, why is all this necessary? On September 11th, there was a U.S. ultimatum to Russia. And they said, guess what? We're taking Afghanistan. Well, there had been a certain war about that, right? The Soviets had been bleeding for 10 years to keep Afghanistan free of foreign control. And then we're taking bases in Central Asia. We're taking Uzbekistan bases and Kyrgyzian bases and more. Now, the question of the nuclear confrontation comes in. Suppose the person sitting in the Kremlin is a bullethead who says, "Nyet! You go into Afghanistan, I'll blow your head off. And I'm mobilizing my nuclear forces, and don't you dare and stay out of Central Asia because we're Holy Mother Russia, and we don't like you. And we're sick of pretending. We're sick of being kicked around. And we're sick of shock therapy and a whole series of other things." I mean, these are perfectly respectable arguments. Now, suppose Putin says no and threatens his own nuclear escalation. Well, you have to be ready for that. You have to have your own illegal escalation and retaliation options built into 9/11. Now, I'm very happy to say that Putin is a very intelligent man, and Putin sat there thinking, well, there's no reason for this. I'll give them enough rope to hang themselves. Essentially saying, well, as long as the neocons are in power in Washington, the United States will become weaker and weaker. They're clearly going to attack Afghanistan. They'll attack Iraq. They'll probably attack Iran. They'll be attacking other people. They're becoming more and more dispersed, more and more casualties, more and more debt, more and more weakness, politically discredited, hated around the world. Whereas Russia, as we've seen, is building up very significant cruise missile forces, ICBMs. We could talk about that at some length. So I submit that this is the main thing that could have happened on 9/11 that didn't happen. And if you pick up a book about 9/11 that doesn't talk to you about the Bush-Putin phone call, any Russian experts, they'll tell you this was an absolute revolution in Russian foreign policy, never before seen, to let the U.S. into Central Asia, or what they call the near abroad, the former Soviet space. So here we have this gang of desperados once again. Again, she was found, Abel Danger found that she was a security risk because she was dealing with China, making money that way. And that would, then the part of it was shut down that had to do with her. Okay, so we know that since November 2005, we're under CONPLAN 8022-22, and that is called Global Nuclear Sneak Attack. At any time, as General Carlson of the 8th Air Force said last year, the B-52s are essentially on alert. That is, under the preemptive plan that they brought in September 2002, the preemption means you've got to be able to deliver nuclear explosives to any part of the globe anytime, and we're ready, says General Carlson. Global strike, they don't call it nuclear sneak attack or worldwide nuclear Pearl Harbor against everybody. They call it global strike. Hair trigger on nuclear war, and again, this is the it is actually technically activated in August, but then formally, officially activated in November. They're ready to go. Here's the general who will do it. And it's amazing. Look at the power wielded by this person. Who's ever heard of him? General Chilton. Who would know? Where are the journalists? Where's the vigilant media that point to the rogue government cockroaches in this or that angle of the Pentagon? Now, everybody knows this one, I hope, since the end of July, we've been on the verge of attacking Iran, the United States. Cheney has tasked STRATCOM with drawing up a contingency plan in response to another 9/11-type terrorist attack on the United States. Now, he does not believe in LIHOP. He believes in MIHOP. He believes in making it happen on purpose. Cheney is not going to sit around doing rain dances until another terrorist attack somehow materializes out of the stratosphere. He is going to make it happen, clearly. So again, this is where, if you have not advanced to the level of MIHOP, you're vulnerable. You're basically for the slaughter. The plan includes a large-scale air assault on Iran with conventional and tactical nuclear weapons, 450 major targets. The reasoning of the neocons is they say, well, in Iraq, the attack went well, the occupation went badly. Let's just have an attack with no occupation, punitive expedition, nuclear bombing, a certain amount of special forces go in, blow things up, get out, no occupation. Air Force officers are appalled, but they're not going to do anything to damage their careers. Right? The American conservative back in August. So since August 1st at the latest, we're on the brink of a nuclear conflagration because they managed to kill some Russians or Chinese, and you'll see how it takes off. Now, at a conference at American University back in July, we talked about these issues, right? Saying, well, if we know that terrorism comes through drills, let's start looking ahead at the drills. Not backwards, but prospectively. Let's see what drills are coming down the road towards us. Well, we identified one called Sudden Response 05, headquarters Fort Monroe, Virginia. That's where that General Burns had been kicked out. And we had these groups, the Total 411 information. I recommend this one. It's the most dramatic. If you want to find out what's going on in the drill world, try this one. It's kind of the tabloid headline version. If you want the absolute encyclopedic detail, try Team 8 Plus. I'm on Cloak and Dagger DE
every
Thursday. Yes, thank you. I even have listeners. And I think you may have to pay something for that.
$30
every
6 months. $30. Well,
anyway, this is what I have. We do some. There are some wild guys coming on there, but I can't be responsible for what other people say. I try to be responsible for what I say. We had on Rents, on WBAI, Maria Heller, if you know her, and the Sarah McLendon Study Group. Sarah McLendon Study Group still goes on, even though she's no longer with us. There was a firestorm on the internet. What was the firestorm? Well, it was that this drill had a nuclear component at the center of it, Sudden Response 05, and this force, there was so much hysteria in Charleston, South Carolina, that the Post and Courier of August 15th said, they've stirred up folks all over the Lowcountry worried that nuclear fallout could seriously ruin their weekend. In other words, when people were told that there was going to be a drill and the premise of the drill was a nuclear bomb going off in their area, they said, we don't want it. Most people will respond this way. And they can be peaceniks, they can be environmentalists, they can just be local, you know, not in my backyard, local activists. Just about anybody would say, no, I don't want it. So this drill was supposed to start on the 18th. It was postponed. On the 19th, it was postponed again. And on the 20th, it was canceled. So there is a concrete example of citizen activism shutting down a dangerous, useless, expensive drill.
We actually got a call on C-SPAN.
You brought it up on C-SPAN. Fantastic.
We did it on C-SPAN, and we also did it on the Off-Bound Show.
Wonderful. I can wrap up now quickly, I think. This was the idea. It was a 10-kiloton nuclear detonation on the coast of the Carolinas. It was also kidnapping congressmen at Fort Bragg. How about that? Congressmen volunteered to be kidnapped as part of the drill. Would they resist a coup, or would they just say, here, take me away?
The Republicans would never...
I think both. I think a bipartisan group. No? There was a movie about this, Special Bulletin. Anybody remember it? 1983? This time it was a bomb from a peacenik, I think, wanted to.
It was in Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay. And here's the precious quote. Each time we do one of these exercises, we try to make it more robust, and we try to add in fidelity. So you tell me what maximum fidelity is. Here's the problem of the gas dispenser in Manhattan, where the gas is going to go. You don't want to know. Shut it down. Bush on August 13th, it
keys in perfectly with these dates that I've been giving you. All options are on the table vis-a-vis Iran. Right? I will attack when I wish to. And there he is. Putin says, look, you know, you're lowering the threshold of nuclear weapons. That's dangerous because somebody may feel tempted to use nuclear weapons. And if that happens, because the U.S. is supposedly going to be using mini nukes on Iran, you might get a nuclear conflict, and that's very dangerous. Now, this is a very responsible and understated way of saying, you know, I have nuclear forces that are actually more than yours. Right? Mine's bigger than yours, so don't start this. War on terror, I don't know, this is sort of the reductio ad absurdum. This is the Chechen murderer, Elias Akhmadov, who lives practically in my neighborhood. He's in Washington, D.C. He's getting a stipend from the State Department. He gets a secretary, an office, a stipend, a nice apartment, and his claim to fame is killing women and children at a hospital in Chechnya in 1995. He's now on the public payroll. In other words, Kandi pays Akhmadov. The Russians have asked for him to be extradited, but they won't. Okay, now StratCom. Ooh. Maybe this will be worth it. Now we have to minimize.
Let's see if we can do it technically.
I have for you. If it works, maybe not, huh?
Just have to set up the slideshow part, I guess.
Is it complex?
Yes.
Okay. Now here we are in the Pentagon. Now this is the one of the people on Team 8 Plus was able to find this. So here's the strategic command, right? The nuclear bombs. Joint exercise briefing from about a year ago. Can you try down? Down one? Try down again.
That was right here. You went down?
Well, no. Do whatever's working. Okay. Look, notice they go by fiscal year. Don't be fooled, right? Don't do calendar year. Do fiscal year. And you can see all the stuff they do. It's color-coded. You notice that this is distributed pretty much through the year. Seems to be fairly equitably distributed. I think that was the main thing I wanted to show with this. But now let's look at the following year. This is where we are now, right? We're here in January. And this is why I said what we had in October, November, December was probably the greatest concentration since 9/11. Now, Global Lightning and Vigilant Shield. One was nuclear bomb goes off in Mobile Bay, Alabama. U.S. thermonuclear confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. Close. I mean, thinkable. Busy night seminars on nuclear, nobody knows. Global Storm. Now remember before on 9/11, we had Global Guardian. Sounds relatively reassuring, right? Now you have Global Storm. Not so reassuring, right? Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Not good. War, right? Warlike. That is because they've changed the name in honor of the new aggressive first strike nuclear posture. You can't have Global Guardian anymore. It has to be Global Storm. Global Lightning, that's the attack on North Korea and Russia, in this pattern. Vigilant Shield, an integral part. Now, Able Warrior, worldwide anti-terror drill. It struck me that might have been the French riots. That's just a guess, right? The French riots of November. Terminal Fury, biological and chemical in the Pacific. Now here we are going into Global Thunder. Not good, huh? Lightning, thunder. Able Warrior again, and Able Ally with NATO. This is what they do. This stuff is going on all the time. Go to Team 8 Plus. You can find this, and there may even be the update. So we can't go into all of this stuff, but the average person is simply bewildered. You have no idea these things are going on, but they are, and this is how they're spending the $500
billion. The lightning and thunder, does it have anything to do with weather manipulation exercise?
It could, but this is StratCom, right? I don't know. These are the people who like nuclear weapons. Now, can we go back to the other one? Back to the other slideshow and just wrap up quickly. I realize people are failing. Anyway, let me just say one thing for sure. You have the Bush White House in crisis.
And some people last fall began thinking, oh my God, he's gonna fall, he's gonna collapse politically. He will not collapse politically until the 9/11 myth is dismantled. He will keep his base of 30 to 35 to 40% of reactionaries and cretins and the indifferent and whatever they are. And he will wage war indefinitely. There is no end to the slaughter, and indeed you'll have a wider war. The neocons say, hey, we're losing in Iraq. We forgot to solve the problem of Iran and Syria. In other words, a psychotic flight forward into a wider war. The only way this can be done is to make the 9/11 issue come to the fore. Now, the other side of the question is, when you're dealing with this, and then go ahead, if we can. Wonderful.
The other one.
It just says New York City and the date.
Yep.
Back in Watergate, you may remember that it was common knowledge for people alive at the time that Nixon was tempted to have a wag the dog moment. He wanted to launch foreign wars in order to distract attention from Watergate. In the Kippur War of October 1973, Nixon called for a total U.S. worldwide thermonuclear alert. The Prime Minister of Great Britain, Edward Heath, a conservative, said this was done purely for political motives. It was purely a political fraud by Nixon and Kissinger to try to deflate Watergate. We are now in that kind of a situation. The desperate neocon fascist madmen of the Bush White House. They are determined to stay in power. A lot of them now face jail. If you take a neocon and ask him, which is better, World War III or you go to jail? The question is answered. Back in Watergate, there are two pieces of evidence we want to cite. Haig and Kissinger, during Watergate, kept special surveillance over the nuclear football with the launch codes. Whenever Nixon asked for it, they would be all over him like an ape, so to speak, so they wouldn't pull him out and try to launch something crazy. In the last days of Watergate, Schlesinger, the Secretary of Defense, put out an order to all U.S. combat commanders saying, if you get an order from Nixon to attack anybody, ignore it, disregard it, until that order is confirmed by me, Schlesinger, or Kissinger. Now, who is there that's going to restrain the Bush White House? I don't know who. I don't see it, except the citizenry, but somehow more has to be done. Now, let me just, just on this. All through the past year, it should be obvious, Bush has no Iraq argument. All these arguments don't turn on Iraq. He always defends himself when his back is to the wall. It's always 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, hard, lessons of 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. There's one. This was last summer. How about that one? Same story. How about this one? Washington Post likes him. September 11th takes center stage. Now what's going on, of course, is the clash of civilizations. We'll just rush through this. The various poles of world civilization, their idea is to play one against the other, right? The idea is that Islam doesn't get along with anybody, let's attack them. Latin America somehow left out here. I've never quite figured that out. Here's World War III, according to Samuel Huntington. This is where you're headed if you don't do something. U.S., Western Europe, Israel, Australia, New Zealand, Russia, Bulgaria, Greece, India, against China, Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, Muslim states, and Japan. Japan, if anything, is unfortunately over in the other column now. The only winners, Latin America and Africa and Indonesia, who remain out of it. And this is the goal. This is what they're fighting for. This is the Bernard Lewis plan for the Middle East. You can see it. Kurdistan, a Sunni desert entity, landlocked. A Shiistan here. Sudan divided into two parts, Pakistan carved up, Pashtunistan, Baluchistan. Notice what happens to Iran. This is now, if you go to a neocon and say, you can't defeat Iran, you say, oh, we have these armies, these ethnic armies, where do you see? We have Arabistan here, a breakaway movement to separate out with the oil area. Turkmen are going to gravitate up here to Turkmenistan. Azeris gravitate here, Kurds over here, Shiites down here, and what's left in the middle is a landlocked Iranistan. And they say after we've bombed them with nuclear weapons, these movements will come to the fore and we'll win the war that way. It's absolute insanity. Absolute insanity.
And these people have to be stopped. We could go into the plans for Syria. At the Axis for Peace conference in Brussels, the Syrians came to the people from the U.S. who were there and said, tell us how we can stop this attack, because it's coming after us and we don't want it. We're not interested in a war. Lebanon divided into various parts and so forth. So this is the threat. If you don't want an endless war for the next 100 years based on this, then make the 9/11 issue explode. Nixon restrained. We've had it. Part of my program, we have a whole series of leftists, left liberals, what can we call them, who don't address the issue. They do not address the myth of 9/11. Chomsky, Amy Goodman, many fine people. Galloway shows a lot of courage, but not on the issue where it absolutely counts, where you get more bang for the buck than anything else, and that's 9/11.